Well, Dr. Keisha, it is such an honor to have you on this segment of Regenerative Medicine Summit. Thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, it's my honor to be here. Thank you so much.
Well, I'd like the audience to know all the incredible work that you're doing. Dr. Keisha Evers is an integrative medicine expert, doctor of sexology. I mean, I would actually love to have just a discussion on that alone. Because that's such an important aspect that people don't realize how important, I mean, how it impacts us. Family practice, ARNP, psychotherapist, herbalist, board certified in functional medicine and Ayurvedic medicine, and is the founder medical director of the Academy of Integrative Medicine Health Coach Certification Program. Dr. Keisha has been in the medical field for over 30 years. You don't look 30.
I'm 57.
that's incredible. That's after conducting the HURT study in 2013, healing unresolved trauma, she developed the HURT model for understanding how past childhood trauma impacts adult health. This led to the creation of the You Unbroken online program for patients to heal their own trauma, at the Mystic Medicine Deep Immersion Healing Retreats she leads at her home in San Juan Island in Washington. Dr. Keisha is a popular speaker, including at Harvard and from the TEDx stage, and the best-selling author of Solving the Autoimmune Puzzle, The Woman's Guide to Reclaiming Emotional Freedom and Vibrant Health, The Quick and Easy Autoimmune Paleo Cookbook, and Inflammatory Recipes with 7 Ingredients or Less for Busy People, and Your Libido Story, a workbook for women who want to find, fix, and free their sexual desire. You've done a lot, doing a lot, and it's amazing. Such a breadth of training and knowledge. I mean, that's incredible. Thank you so much for being here.
I always say whenever anyone came in my office and stumped the chump went back to school.
Is that the truth?
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit, I mean, how did you start this journey? What made you kind of get into the niche that you're in right now, working on autoimmune, trauma? I mean, these are big things.
Yeah. Well, I think like any of us, I find as I run my own summits, the stories of the people that are experts in their fields are compelling. And so it's I'm definitely no exception. I started out in a very, I would describe myself as an adrenaline junkie in my early days. A very high intensity medicine was what I loved. I was a nurse in the hospital, in the ICU, ER, life flight, balloon pump team. Like I just loved that. And I did that for about 10 years. I was raising 4 children. I was a marathon runner. Before I started having kids, I used to skydive. I mean, I just loved that kind of adrenaline. And then, and this is the way my patients describe this too. All of a sudden I woke up sick one morning, right? And of course that's not how it works, but that's how I felt it also. And it was because I was completely disassociated from my body and wasn't listening to the many warning signs along the way that it had given me. So one day I woke up and I had 10 pounds of just extra puffiness and fluid over my joints throughout my body. They were red and inflamed. I was flattened. It was like someone had taken the batteries out of the Energizer bunny. So I got in to see a doctor and she asked me in the course of the history taking process, if I had a family history of autoimmune disease. And I said, you know, I think my grandfather had rheumatoid arthritis and was in a wheelchair when he died. And he died at the age I am right now. And I never knew him. And she said, oh, well, that's what you have. And, you know, here, pulls off of her prescription pad 2 prescriptions. Here are 2 prescriptions. Take them. And when you get worse, come back. Not if, when. And yeah, it was for methotrexate and for a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug, which this has not changed in all of these years. It's the same exact thing that went on then.
Yeah.
And so I remember on my way home, I always tell my patients and students, you know, if an herb had bitten me on the bottom, I would have known what it was. I was completely born and raised into the Western medical paradigm. And so I just remember for the very first time as I was driving home that day that maybe there was something else out there. Like I didn't even know it wasn't an East versus West or an alternative versus, you know, I just didn't even know anything else in order to look. And so I thought, you know, I'll just start on the internet. And back in those days, it was, I asked Jeeves about rheumatoid arthritis on a dial-up modem. And, you know, as I started going deeper, I went into PubMed where we keep our medical research, and I found a compelling article on yoga and autoimmune disease. And I found myself in my first yoga class the following morning, and I was holding those postures as the yoga teacher was wandering around the studio talking, and he said enough about this word Ayurveda, which is the sister science of yoga, that's the medical arm of it, 10,000 years ago. And he said enough that piqued my interest that I went back home afterwards and looked that up. And what I discovered about Ayurvedic medicine was so interesting to me because, first of all, it was a paradigm shift that was revolutionary on two levels. One was, we're not all the same. And I had never, ever contemplated that, you know, like we're trained inside the Western paradigm to drugs. Like, here's your list of drugs. Here are your diagnoses. This is the drug that matches it. You know, here's your list of side effects. Here's what to look for, drug-drug interaction, you know, like that's it. And so that's how I was raised, you know, here's the cookbook. And we have this thing called evidence-based standardized medical care, standardized medicine, implying that we're standardized people, and we are not. And Ayurveda was the first thing that showed me that, like, oh, we are not all the same. And in fact, we need to be fed and watered and taken for walks differently from each other, you know, just basic things. And that was new for me. I know that's sad, but it was. And then the second thing that was brand new, revolutionary, sky parting with the clouds and the angels singing and the sunbeam shining on me was Ayurvedic medicine said autoimmune disease is undigested anger. And I remember going, wait, you know, like, you mean you have to digest your feelings? You have to digest your experiences and your memories?
I didn't realize. I thought digestion was, you know, processing food, but
wait, just a second. I don't get this, you know? And then the second ball that drops, you know, is, oh, that means, wait, but I'm not an angry person. And so, you know, like this all, I remember like the second thought from that was, well, maybe that's a problem. You strapping on your running shoes or being, making yourself busy, doing some high intensity thing, being a perfect mother, perfect wife, perfect everything, maybe a distraction from having to actually feel your feelings. And so, you know, and I just remember thinking, oh, I think the way that I've been doing things is what's gotten me sick. That was really important. And then the next thing that happened was autoimmune means I'm attacking myself. So is there a time in my life that I wanted to die? Because I certainly don't now. And I'm basically committing suicide in a societally acceptable manner. So then, you know, I learned to meditate. I became a yoga teacher. And during my training, during all of that process, I just like kept asking that question, like, and one day in my meditation, I went back with that, like, very clear, let's look for a place where maybe your cells agreed with you. Maybe you said you wanted to die, you know, and I really got like, that's possible that maybe you set this up a long time ago. And sure enough, as I went backwards with that thought in mind, I ran into my 10-year-old little girl version of myself who was being sexually abused by the vice principal of the elementary school that I was attending. And my dad was out to sea in the Navy. We'd moved a lot in my lifetime. And I was raised with no television. And I don't even think I knew, like, it was 1975. I get it. Like, but we had just moved from Japan. And I don't think I knew the word sex. I don't think that I knew the word of like abuse or molestation. I don't think I had the right words to tell my mom. I know I tried to tell her like I didn't want to go to school, but I don't think I really knew how to tell her what was happening because I don't think I knew. And the vice principal was saying, you know, you're a bad kid. That's why this is happening. So, you know, there's this little girl that I found in this meditation sitting there. She wanted off the planet. You know, like she was talking to angels. She was trying to figure out why people behave the way they did, like what she was doing wrong, you know, and of course, little child brains are not fully developed. We don't have a prefrontal cortex till we're 26 years old. So everything is self-centered, you know, or like, what is this? Like, what am I doing wrong? If your parents are getting divorced, that's the way kids are, right? And so for me, if I'm told you're a bad kid and that's why this is happening, then of course I'm going to believe that. So of course that set up this perfectly aligned belief system that something's wrong with me, that goes with the feeling of I'm not good enough, right? That is anxiety and panic in my system, my nervous system. And then the behavioral strategy that you learn to make as an adaptive behavior for your beliefs and meanings that you create in response to your sympathetic nervous system overdrive to the emotions that you feel. For me, it was perfectionism. I have to be perfect if I'm going to survive. And so I was really perfecting perfectionism when I got sick. I was pretty perfect at it. Driving myself so hard, right? And
other than being sick, you were perfect.
I was perfect at that too, believe me. Yeah. Overachiever. And
I
so
was the best at attacking myself.
I was the best at attacking myself, exactly. And so I remember going, oh, I bet that this time period of really wanting off this planet actually does have something to do with my disease process 20 years later. And sure enough, later science does support that with the adverse childhood experiences study. And then I did a study in 2013 that shows how that all transpires. But, you know, it was good because I was able to say, oh, I set this up, and then go into trauma healing, as well as some of the other things like change the diet. But I had already done those things and that I was reading about, and I'd only gotten about 70% better. And when I really got into the trauma part and unhooked from, oh, I have to be perfect, you know, and started healing and self-confronting my own ways of perceiving myself and the world, my RA reversed within 6 months and it's never been back. And I never took those medications. And so then I started devoting my education and, you know, everything else from there on toward doing this. Long answer to that question.
No, I mean that is what people, it's really important for people to understand that some of these things that, well, that happened long time ago. Yeah, you know, I was just a kid, you know, I've already forgiven them, or I've already, you know, a lot of patients say that. And then we start looking at the emotions around that yes, maybe your adult version said, oh, I forgive you. But the child is still
screaming in there. Yeah. Yeah. That's the thing, is I hear that a lot, obviously, because I call this one of the four corners of the puzzle that you solve, because we're each unique puzzles. But the four corners I call out are genetics, your gut health, your toxic load and burden, and then trauma. Mm-hmm. And I often hear what you just said, like, oh, I've done so much work about this, like years and years and years of therapy, and yet they're still sitting in front of me with breast cancer or an autoimmune disease, you know. Then I very gently have to say, and you're at your next layer, right? This is not a one and done kind of situation. It's layer after layer after layer. And I remember being in therapy, opening my eyes, looking at the therapist and saying, am I going to go back here forever for the rest of my life? I'm so tired of going here, you know. And it was actually to a different place than this. Mm-hmm. And she looked at me and it was sort of like, oh, grasshopper, you know, she said, and I'll never forget, like, just the kindness in the way that she said this. And she said, these moments in childhood, and everyone has trauma. Every child has trauma. It may not be capital T trauma like we're talking about, but we all have had trauma. And these moments are the times that you are basically digging the mine shafts, right? And you will then go down them again and again and again in adulthood to bring up the gems of wisdom. And she said, like, don't be afraid of that mind shaft. You know, you have another gem that's waiting for you down there every single time you think you're done. And so I was like, oh, that helps. Like, that helps to put a realistic perspective on, until the rest of my life is done in this body, this will be part of where I get my wisdom from. And okay, that's good. I don't have to kind of think that I'm closing the doors at some point on this and never thinking about it again. It doesn't mean that, you know, that you're always visiting the rawness and the pain. No, like, you can tell, I talk about this, I tell the story, and, you know, I'm at that place where there's post-traumatic growth and wisdom from it. And you can even say, thank goodness that my soul set this up for its growth and learning, right? That, but you don't hurry to that place. You don't rush to get to that place, right? The body has to be brought along. The small child part of you has to be brought along. All the small children parts of you, like, it all has to be done in a way that's integrative, kind, unfolding, compassionate. Yeah.
And we're so used to, in this Western society, like where you're saying, yeah, this drug, this pill, you know, I have these symptoms, give me a drug and then it will all be gone. You know, and it's that kind of suppression, quick fix type of mentality. And when you work on trauma, it's like you're saying, it's not a quick fix. So you can't use that model in this type of scenario. The whole idea is the stillness, the patience, the, you know, allowing the process to take place in whichever way that it unfolds. It's not controllable. It is, you have to allow the process to kind of unfold while you're present, rather than trying to say, well, now I want to do this or now I want to do that. You know, so it's such a different mindset.
For sure.
And it's not a cerebral mindset. It's not something that you logically can think. It is because it's operating from your survival mechanism, like the little child in you just wanted to survive.
Right.
Yeah.
And that figure, I have a very strong figure outerer, obviously. I have a lot of letters behind my name. And so there is a time in my life where I thought, if I just learn enough, then the world will be safe for me, right? And, or I'll feel good about myself, good enough, right? And so the figure or outerer is actually a part of your ego. It's a part that you generate from a child perspective. And you can see that, like, I'm in school, 10 years old. So someone's telling me I'm not doing something right. So I devote my life to figuring things out as a way of feeling safe, right? So you find those parts inside of you, and they have learned some really beautiful skills, and there's a shadow part to it. And so that's a lot of the work I do in trauma healing retreats and working with different kinds of modalities, is really learning, like, what is the gift from the parts you've developed in childhood in response to your experiences, how to digest and get rid of the hurt, the resentment. I always think resentment is the number one cause of cancer. Resentment, you know, it's like the hot tub you put your cells in that just is so toxic. And it's not a chemical generated by factories out there and dumped into the air, water, and soil. It's generated right here. And it impacts how you express your genetics. It impacts your gut health. It impacts how well you can get rid of your toxic burden, right? And it all stems from usually trauma, and it's in undigested forms. So, you know, these are all such important, I think, parts of the conversation we're talking about healing and regenerating, right? Yeah, when we talk about aging, we age a lot faster when we are pouring toxins from our own mind into ourselves.
And in regards to genetics, and what many people don't understand is that genes are turned on and turned off. And so we can choose the combination of genes that are turned on and turned off by our emotional setup. Yeah, so that resentment or that trauma, by holding on to that or not resolving that, that will then shift our genes, how they express themselves, in a less favorable way, which will then speed up things like aging, and that will reduce our abilities, our cells to regenerate, and it will reduce our mitochondria, our functioning. Like, you know, if you hold a trauma, let's say anger, you know, tends to be gravitate towards the liver, you know, then that liver will then, the circulation will be less, there'll be less nutrients going to that organ, there'll be less toxins that are getting out of that organ. And so you just see the compounding effect by not going through the process, going down the mine shaft and working, you know, grabbing those jewels, you know. So
yeah,
it is so important.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, I mentioned earlier this, you know, the unfolding, letting your mind unfold with some helpful, you know, when I give talks, I am on the faculty for the Institute for Functional Medicine. And when I teach this stuff to medical providers, you know, one of the things I always say is, please stop telling your patients to reduce their stress. You know, like, that's just so ridiculous, you know. So they have, someone's got a special needs child and you're going to reduce them somehow, you know, or a job they love, but it's very stressful and you're somehow going to reduce that, you know? So there's just a really interesting way we think about that is, it's off the mark. It's just a little bit off, right? And it's how we perceive ourselves in our lives, you know? So you can have five people that see the same movie and we'll have five different take-home messages. It's the same is true, like five people having the same life experience will have a different perception of it. So it's learning how to shift your perceptual filters so that when you are filtering your information that comes through what Tibetan Buddhism calls your six minds, not one mind, which I love. Those guys have really got a handle on how the brain works. Thousands and thousands of years, you know, like how that mind, how you can actually become master of your own mind rather than it running you. And what they say is, you know, one perception takes 17 different steps. Who knew? In like an instant, you know, if you're saying, if you see that I'm wearing navy blue, right? Okay, so you registered navy blue. It took 17 different steps to say navy blue in your mind. And they're saying like you get input from your eye mind, your nose mind, your mouth mind, so the five senses, plus the mind that synthesizes it all. And we can't take the information in from the five sense organs at the same time. And we do know this, right? It's like a movie projector. You're going to do audio and visual like this really fast and it'll overlay on each other. And then, but if you slow it down enough, you'll start to be able to see that they're separate. And so that's one of the advantages of meditation is to be able to, like what I was doing when I went back and said, so is there a time when I wanted to die? You know, I was slowing things down enough and opening space between stimulus and reaction, like an elevator door. And saying, okay, in that gap, is there a different response I can make that my child mind didn't understand or know or didn't have a fully developed brain to do? So you actually can change all of this. It can all be healed. And that's the beautiful part of this. Like I always say, I never talk about anything you can't change. And so in that perception, you know, if you're slowing things down, they call it the gateway to karma, halfway through those 17 steps, how you've done it always is how you will always do it in the future, unless you stop it in that midway point, create just enough of a gap where you create a response that comes from now the wisdom that you've attained in life. And then you can shift the way that you've always done things in terms of how you think about them, how you respond to them. And so this is why, like when we do cognitive behavioral therapy, it never works. It, you know, just trying to change a behavior at a behavior level doesn't really work. You can't say, I'm just going to stop eating sugar usually and have it work forever. So it's like, oh, sugar was in the freshly baked desserts that were permeating my household when I was a child, when I came back from school after those terrible experiences, and represented safety So the aroma of a freshly baked dessert, the taste of it as an after school snack, and voila, I've got a sugar addiction that lasted a real long time until I was diagnosed, you know, a real long time. And so, you know, many times along the way, I said, I got to stop eating sugar. I would try and like strong arm myself into it. And no, there was like a child part in there, where that aroma, the mouthfeel, the taste, the grounded space inside of my body for just that short period of time until everything crashes, you know, was like, oh, I feel better, right? So this is where addictions come from. This is it right here. And it's creating that gap where you can say, okay, so here's where this started. I need to heal that child part and what was going on there so that then I can respond differently. I don't have to use the same behavior that she or he decided back then. Yeah.
And that's the thing is that, you know, like sugar, I mean, we know sugar is bad. We know alcohol is bad. We know smoking is bad. I mean, we know this cognitively, but like you're mentioning, it's what it relates to, you know, what emotion does it connect with? Right. And, you know, what is the purpose of doing that? You know, because we're trying to recreate a feeling that we're wanting to hold. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So whether it is then that I want to kill myself or whether I want to feel safety. And a lot of times these are kind of intertwined in a way.
Or numb out my anxiety or stop the intrusive thoughts about I'm not good enough or I don't have the life I wish I had or whatever it is. God doesn't love me, you know, like. That's another thing that's always really interesting to work with people on is how come I'm being punished, you know, disease as punishment. Oh, that's so heartbreaking. Do you ever hear that?
I do. Yeah. It's.
I'm like, can we take out our Bibles and turn to Job? This is not a punishment. Yeah. God never said that you are going to be without challenge in this lifetime. And in fact, we have evidence.
Right here.
Right here.
Yeah. Whatever he went through, and God loved this person.
I know, right? Yeah. And the idea that somehow if you're righteous or you do everything right, you're not, then you won't have any challenges or health difficulties. That is, it's so off the mark, you know, and it causes so much suffering. So then it takes on this, like, what am I doing wrong? What have I done wrong? Why is God punishing me? Why, you know, I'm righteous. I do everything right. I'm a good, whatever you want to say. And then why am I, you know, and I remember giving a talk. There were probably 1,000 people in the audience when I was on stage, and this downloaded in the moment I was in the middle of my talk. And I remember thinking and saying it out loud, saying, I'd welcome feedback on this afterwards if anyone wants to come and find me. But it just occurred to me that we have these very odd expectations, like your children are never supposed to die before you. Like, where'd we ever get that? Or, you know, that you're supposed to live a certain shelf life and then die in your sleep and not suffer if you do everything right. You know, and I just remembered that just came through and going, nobody has ever said this to us. Like, this is not a lifetime guarantee with refunds if you're not happy. This is not how it works, you know. Like, actually, life is guaranteed to give you challenges in all shapes and forms. And so, you know, what is it that you get from that is not what you've done wrong, but what is meant to be learned here, and how can I be an instrument in your hands? You know, like, yeah, I mean, Christ in the Garden of Gethsemane didn't say, what did I do wrong, but did say, like, can this cup move on? I really don't want to do this. And then went,
it kind of sucks, but okay.
Oh, yeah, not my will, but your will. That's right, you know. Okay. Yeah. So that idea of surrendering of control, right? That's so huge. I think that's our biggest addiction is to control. And I think it's one of the great big trauma patterns that leads to disease. If I just can control everything, then I'll feel safe. And it's a rigidity that happens inside the system that lacks surrender. The cell has to have an ability to get rid of garbage and bring in nutrients. It can't be rigid. It has to be soft and semi-permeable. And so if our thoughts are rigid, our cells will be rigid, right?
And that's exactly it. Yeah, one of the, it was a fascinating thing. I was talking to a friend of mine, the other day, and he was doing this kind of transcendental meditation, you know, back in the, I think it was back in the 90s or something like that. And it was getting really heavy into it. And he was working with this one lady, and she was dealing with a disconnect with a twin, and that was really bothersome to her. And she felt all this suffering on life, and thought it was really, felt life was really hard. And so they were able to get to a point where she was able to experience herself prior to coming into this life. And feeling those kind of those changes of your, that kind of light energy, light spirit, and each time your energy is getting denser and denser as you then moving in towards a physical form. But she also remembered the excitement of coming into this world and all the things that she was getting to experience that she would not be able to experience in the form that she was in prior to. And so after this experience, you know, my friend was asking her, well, so having seen this, having felt this, would you wish that you would have made another choice? And she said, no, not at all. You know, she said she was so excited for all the tribulations and all the hardships and all the things that she was going to experience. Mm-hmm. And to learn from this perfect lab that we're at, you know, to learn all these cool experiences, you know, trauma and all. But with that, then we are also needing to look for the tools that you are teaching, that you are giving people to move through these things, because we're not meant to be stuck in them. We're right. Meant to learn from them. And that is the key then to be able to move towards tools that we can use to be able to grow as individuals and be a better servant, to experience joy and to live life at its fullest.
Exactly. And, you know, and Ayurvedic medicine has this concept of five different layers. We're not just a physical body. We have five bodies. They call them sheaths. So you've got your physical that has your genetics and your organs and glands and tissues and systems. And then next to that is your energy body, which we now know exists through our own scientific methods, right? Through Carlian photography. And then we have next to that our emotional mental body. And this is where that undigested thing happens, right? Where we get stuck places in our emotional mental body. And then wisdom body, and then spiritual body. And the spiritual body is the portal that Carl Jung would call is that portal to the collective unconscious that we're all privy to. And we don't get to hang out there in our wisdom and spiritual bodies as often as we want to when we're toxed in these others, right? And so we get stuck in that denseness, right? Where it gets subtler and subtler and lighter out here. And so, you know, it's really important in terms of how we, as you said, express our genetics, how our organs behave, how we perceive, you know, if we say, oh, I'm not, something's not right. Something's not the way I want it. My expectations aren't being met. Somebody's, you know, I mean, I hear all the time, like stupid people that don't agree with you are, you know, stupid people are the ones that don't agree with you, right? And so the intelligent ones are the ones that you agree with. And we have a lot of polarization in our society these days, and a lot of people are really activated and triggered by people that don't agree with them. And so what will happen is, you know, the mind then says, uh-oh, this isn't okay, and then sends a message to the adrenal glands, which say, oh, fight, flight, freeze, or faint, you know, and now you're off to the races. You're pumping out cortisol, breaking down your gut wall, and then you become intolerant to the food that you're eating because that's making its way through, and the immune system is saying, whoa, I'm I attack anything that's not me, and here's this thing, broccoli, that's not me. And you start like becoming intolerant to the oddest things, right? Because you're intolerant in your mind to what's going on over here and to your thoughts. And so then your body becomes intolerant to the environment that it's in. So that then keeps a negative feedback loop that keeps you stuck in this very dense place, instead of being able to go, you know, oh, there's this really beautiful place I can hang out, you know, right? So getting the mental emotional detoxification is vital, because through the, you know, 720,000 nadis, shrotas, and nerves that, you know, through Ayurvedic and Tibetan medicine, Chinese medicine, they talk about, you know, these are your acupuncture points where they cross. We have 720,000 of these places. That's why acupuncture works, you know, and it's feeding information from your emotional world into the rest of your system. Your vagus nerve is very famous these days. And, you know, we talk about vagal nerve stimulation and all about the vagus nerve, but, you know, like, we want to go above that. We don't want to always be talking about that nerve and getting it to do what we want it to do. It's like, what's triggering you in the first place, right?
And that's the thing, is that, I mean, like the vagus nerve, we talk about the sympathetic, parasympathetic, and be able to shift back and forth. So we have a challenge enough to shift, you know, stay away from the sympathetic, which are, you know, fight or flight or kill, you know, immune system activities and all these things, towards the parasympathetic. But then what you're talking about is even, you know, so once we can learn that, then we can move into, you have all these other layers of experience and other layers of fluidity that you can move into to experience life at a such bigger and better and more and richer way. You know, we have all these five layers of body, and each layer, I mean, you should be able to move awareness in and out, and
right.
Yeah, depending on what it is that you're wanting to experience, you can then experience it with these different layers of who you are.
Right. And we're much vaster than we think we are. You know, we're so limited by these bodies in terms of that's where we begin and end. And when really, like, after you shed the mortal coil, after you die and this body is left behind, you who you are is limitless, you know? And so it's like, if you can, I call it going from eagle to mouse perspective, you know, like if you're in a mouse, you're that child space where you're scurrying around, you can only see right what's in front of you. Everything looks fairly dangerous, because when you're a kid, it is, you know, and you're really low on the predator list. And so it's like, that's kind of how it works. Yeah. And you're looking up at everything. But when you're an adult, you're an eagle, and you have the ability to see a larger vision, to be able to say, this is only one part of something much bigger, and it's just a dot, you know. And to be able to have the resilience to come in. And I notice this when people are working with integrative medicine too, sometimes they'll get really want to drill down into every single snip of their genetics and, you know, like get enmeshed in the bark of the tree. And I'm like, okay, pull away, like get the big picture, right? Because this one snip is really part of something really a lot bigger. So I always think like of that resilience, being able to move back and forth, that we call this heart rate variability. And, you know, when we talk about heart math and the ability to move from a stress related response to a rest and digest one, that requires resilience. And perspective is also a way of being able to, like, how you change your perceptions, the resilience to stop, create a gap, right? Have a response that comes from maybe your older, wiser self. You know, physics tells us that time's not linear, that we actually have the one that was conceived and the one that will die from this body all in the same cell of time. It's not a line. So you have access to every single part of you. It's already in there, all the information. And so if you want to access an older, wiser version of you, like Grandmother Willow and Pocahontas, like, what would she say right now about something, you know, instead of the upset child part of you, you know, that one may have a very limited way of thinking, a very mouse way. So you actually can move with fluidity. This is, we now know that well-being is all about resilience, that aging well is resilience, that the ability to move out of a state of cancer and autoimmunity is resilience. That's what it takes.
And it's not about avoiding difficult experiences, you know, because we, like, mm-hmm. like we talked about, like you're mentioning, nobody said that, you know, a child is supposed to die after you, and nobody said this and that. I mean, we are here for, I mean, this is like the best learning school. This is the best, you know, place where you can really experience these life events and then use tools, you know, to be able to move through them. And so it is, we should just say no to, I want to just be safe. I want everything to be perfect. That's not the purpose of living. Yeah, the purpose of living, exactly what you're mentioning. It's that resilience and the experience and yeah.
Yeah. And don't get me wrong, any of my four kids die before me, I'm going to be devastated. I don't want that to sound flippant. But at the same time, I don't have an expectation that I'm somehow robbed or they're robbed of their lives, or, you know, I'm a conscious dying doula too. I've done a lot in hospice and conscious dying. And my daughter had, this is one of my bad mother moments that I tell sometimes when I'm doing trauma retreats. And it only happened like 4 months ago. So this is not old.
This is like your experienced and trained self that's doing this right?
This is experienced and trained self. So my 28-year-old daughter had just gotten a puppy, and we're very, very dog people in my household. I have three. We love our dogs, and we are dogs. Like, we like to be fed and water and everything. We like to be petted and cuddled. And, you know, if anyone says, what's your favorite thing to do? It's what I'm doing in the moment. You know, I'm a dog. And so she's gotten this puppy, and she's really bonded and attached to this puppy. And she goes, oh, Mom, like, I have so much anxiety that something will happen to Nova, that, like, I love her so much, it aches. Like, I don't know what would happen if she died. And I said, well, honey, you might want to picture her dead a few times a day just so that you can, you know. And she goes, Mom, sometimes I don't want to do your exercises. I was like, she goes, when I have children, you're not going to be doing that, are you? I said, oh, fair point.
Too many exercises for you.
Okay. You're right, honey. Sorry.
I love it. So for listeners out there that are, you know, they're dealing with autoimmune, they're dealing, let's say, cancer, because I mean, you dealt with breast cancer as well, from what I understand. Yeah, yeah. So it's, I mean, it's all those fears, you know, that people, I mean, the word cancer is just a scary word. Yeah. So for those people that are out there thinking that maybe I don't feel quite myself, I don't feel like, you know, I'm happily living, I don't feel like I live life at its fullest, or maybe, you know, because you have that aspect, and then you have, you know, autoimmune, and then even worse, cancer. Yeah, so what are some directions that you can give those people, that these are the steps that I would suggest that you would take next?
Yeah, so I'm just going to briefly tell the story of my breast cancer so I can put this in context. So 10 years after I had reversed my RA, my son came home from college and said, Mom, I need to tell you something. And I said, this sounds serious. And he said, it is. And we sat down at the dining room table, and he said, do you remember when we lived here? And me and his brother were sexually abused by a neighbor boy. And this is a boy that was 12 when they were 5 and 3. And it was the son of a friend of mine, and would come over and play. And I just remember I had my youngest daughter on my hip, and I had opened the sliding glass doors. I was looking at all of them jumping on the trampoline and saying, hey, and I said his name, do you want to just hang out here and play with them, and I'll pay you to babysit while I go to the grocery store and come back, you know, then all of you guys can just hang and I'll call your mom and ask if it's okay. And he said, yeah. Well, during a couple of those times, then this happened. And I just remember, because of my own experience, that was like the very worst thing that I could have heard as far as on my watch this happened. And I just like this guttural primal, you know, release came for me. And I said, why didn't you tell me when you were younger? And he said, because of this, I didn't want my childhood defined by this. And I didn't want, you know, like, so I immediately went into this, I call it the ICU nurse. She goes into crisis mode and gets things done. And I located the now grown man and asked him, you know, I called him up and he said, I've been waiting for this call, Mrs. Ewers, for 15 years, you know, and, you know, I said, well, I have a few questions for you. And so we did some talking and then I had him pay for some of their therapy. And we ultimately did this very amazing. I facilitated this exercise, this forgiveness exercise after they'd gone through. I mean, it was just amazing. It was so beautiful. And over a few month period, about 4 months after that, I wound up with a lump in my breast and went in. I had diagnostic ultrasound and had this really beautiful blood supply to it. And as I looked at it on the screen, I was like, I know where that came from. It was in my left breast, right over my heart. And I said, give me a month and then I'll be back. But I know what this is from. In all of this, I had done all this work to forgive him. I'd got, you know, facilitated all these things like taking care of my kids. And I was just filled with self-recrimination and loathing for the, you know, and I could go back to that moment of just that sliding glass door, opening it with her on my hip and just like screaming at this younger version of myself, like, take your kids, you lazy cow. Like just like, you know, oh my gosh, it was so deep and dark how much I wanted to kill her for doing this. Like really, like, ugh. And I went, okay, I know exactly what I have to do. And it was the hardest thing I have ever done. Forgiving my vice principal, yeah, easy. Forgiving even who hurt my kids was much easier than forgiving myself. And I went into the jungle and I worked with some ayahuasca for a week. I did trauma therapy. I mean, I really like into it. And I finally got to a place where I could forgive myself. And I even got to a place where I realized it was a form of self-abuse to take the wisdom of the version you are now and turn it on the younger version of you who doesn't have that information and crucify them for that, right? Like, it's just not okay to do that. That's self-abuse. And so I got to that where I could even get there. I went back in, I had another ultrasound, and there was no tumor. It was gone, completely gone. Like the blood supply was just hanging there. And, you know, I don't tell that story often because I don't want people thinking, you know, but I had already, like, you can think your way out of cancer or whatever. I always think we're individual puzzles. Each of us is very different. I'm loaded with breast cancer genetics in my family. My mom's had it, every first degree relative, like it's there. I do not excrete 4-hydroxyestrogen metabolites very easily. And so, you know, that's there. The thing that tipped it into a tumor, into the dense blood supply, was actually me hating myself. And so when you say what's next, I have found throughout the years, that was probably 17 years ago when this happened, I have found throughout the years that oftentimes a lack of self-compassion is at the root. And so when you say like, what's next step? The thing that I will normally say to people in a summit interview such as this is just for 24 hours, watch your own thoughts, develop what they call a witness mind or an observer's mind, and really don't go to sleep to it. Stay awake to exactly what your thought patterns are. You have like 94,000 thoughts a day. I don't know who counts them, but supposedly at least 65% of those are recycled. So you're going to have themes, intrusive, thematic, ruminating circles and cycles you do just automatically. Become awake to those. Look at your operating system. Start seeing what's going on in the background. And just for 24 hours, don't judge them. Don't do anything about it. Just watch and see what the tone is that you're using to speak to yourself and others, what the theme is, what are intrusive ruminating ones versus life supporting sustainable ones. What's the verbiage you use? Start right there. And there's a really lovely exercise you can do where you get some black pebbles and some white pebbles. And at the end of the day, for every life destructive thought you've had, put a black pebble in the middle of the table or on the floor, wherever you are. And for every life supportive and sustaining one, celebratory gratitude thought that you've had, put a white one in there. And at first you might be astonished at how many black ones are and how few white ones. But by doing this very kinesthetic visual process with the stones, during the next day, you can start catching yourself and go, oh, that's a black stone. I don't want to put it in the middle of the pile. I can change that. And you start to realize that your mind, even though you believe it's the master, need not be. That you are in charge. This luminous awareness, this expansive consciousness, if you will keep it awake, it can be master if you allow it. And so awake awareness is what you're developing when you stay constantly alert to your own, and you don't do what I call lazy mind and go into defaults from these old trauma patterns. And so that's like the most powerful thing that you can do.
I love that. I love that. And I love the kind of the physical, because then you can kind of, you have a physical anchor as to what's going on with your mind. I mean, I usually tell my patients that thoughts are like the birds, flying in the sky. I mean, they fly by and you can't really control that they fly by. You can observe them, but you can't control if they're going to land on your head. So it's the same thing.
Check your eyeballs out. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, let's not do that.
Yeah.
Let's do an Alfred Hitchcock kind of scenario.
Exactly. Yeah. Which is what I was doing when I got cancer.
Yeah, exactly. You just allow that to take place. But yeah, so you can't judge yourself on the thoughts. You can't judge yourself. And just like what you're saying is that just observe. Don't engage. Just kind of observe and see what your thoughts are, and just know that your thoughts are not you. They are just taking place. I was looking at all the amazing courses and masterminds and everything that you're doing for an individual that just want to kind of start the process and kind of looking at things, within their own life. I mean, where would be a good place for them to kind of start to dip their toe in and learn?
My website, drkeesha.com, drkeesha.com. My book, Solving the Autoimmune Puzzle, is a great place to start. And then there's a link there that when you get the book, if you put in your receipt number, that we give you a recorded book study program that I did on it, where you take a really deep dive into each chapter and some of the practices, worksheets and things like that. So that's a great place to begin.
I love it. Well, Dr. Keesha, it's been such a pleasure, such an honor, and such incredible work that you're doing. Thank you so much. I love
it. Appreciate you. Bye, everybody.